basically give you basic information. Very warm, plenty of sunshine, high of 77. But they also editorialized today, it will feel like late summer.
It sure does.
And then tomorrow, warm as well. Not as warm, high 71. And then we're going to take a turn toward more, shall we say, seasonable weather on Thursday.
I saw 29 there somewhere in the forecast.
Well, Sunday night's low, 25.
Hey, yikes.
Ooh, okay, just let's think about today and the beautiful weather, one step at a time, one day at a time, the beautiful weather, and our fall fun drive.
Yes.
We are over halfway through. We are ending it on Friday at midnight, so we need to hear from folks today, 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. We've got radio chat skill coming up after NPR News headlines. I know you spoke to the Ulster County Board of Elections. Mm-hmm. Which is coming with some information, and then also some information about some voter ID misinformation in Ulster County we'll tell you about as well. We also have a special from Cats Cast, a special segment on the witches of the Catskills.
Ooh.
It's a spooky season. That's all coming up after the news. Donate now.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. There are just 2 weeks to go until Election Day. The presidential candidates are focusing on swing states. Former President Donald Trump campaigned in one of them yesterday. He met faith leaders near Charlotte, North Carolina. His appeal to religious voters has succeeded with Marion Betances of Pennsylvania, another swing state.
I voted for him because of the Christian values. I believe that America has lost its values.
But supporters of Vice President Harris disagree, such as Pauline Lennon, also of Pennsylvania.
There's no question. At the very least, she will preserve our democracy. And that's what this is about. More than anything.
Donald Trump has repeatedly said that Democrats are one of the greatest threats to the country and, quote, the enemy from within. An NPR investigation has found that Trump has threatened to investigate, prosecute, or punish rivals more than 100 times. NPR's Tom Dreisbach reports.
Trump has promised to investigate President Joe Biden. He's posted that former President Barack Obama should face a military tribunal. Vice President Kamala Harris should be prosecuted. And journalists should be jailed if they don't reveal their sources.
And if the reporter doesn't want to tell you, it's bye-bye. The reporter goes to jail.
NPR found more than 100 examples of Trump threatening his rivals, critics, and even private citizens just since 2022. And that has legal experts worried, like Ian Bassin with the group Protect Democracy.
This is how autocrats cement their permanent grip on power.
A spokesperson for the Republican Party responded by saying Harris is the threat to democracy. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Israel on his latest visit to the Middle East. He's met Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The Biden administration says it continues to back a ceasefire for Gaza and in Lebanon against Hezbollah. Later, Blinken will fly to other Arab nations to meet leaders there. Stocks opened lower this morning as the International Monetary Fund offered a mixed forecast for global economic growth. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 190 points in early trading.
The IMF has raised its forecast for the U.S. economy, projecting growth this year of 2.8%, thanks in part to strong consumer spending. That's significantly better than the Eurozone, where the IMF is projecting growth of less than 1%. China, the world's second largest economy, is expected to grow by 4.8% this year. General Motors is reporting better than expected profits during the most recent quarter, despite a drop in U.S. sales. The average price of a new GM car held steady at more than $49,000. Gassing up a car is getting cheaper. AAA reports the average price of regular gas dipped to $3.16 a gallon. That's down 4 cents from a week ago and 39 cents lower than this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Leaders from nations with developing economies are meeting in Russia this week for the BRICS summit. BRICS is an acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The leaders will look at stronger economic ties. But the host, Russian President Vladimir Putin, is expected to show himself as a strong international leader. Medical groups in Democratic Republic of the Congo are reporting unprecedented levels of sexual assault, especially in camps for internally displaced people. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel has more.
The camps are in the eastern part of the country where there's an active conflict. According to a new report out today from Physicians for Human Rights, sexual violence is widespread and severe. Many of the victims report being attacked by armed militias in the area. Ramatou Touré is chief of child protection with UNICEF in the DRC.
When you go to the camps, almost every girl or every woman has experienced sexual violence.
She says there aren't enough doctors to provide the care these women need, from HIV protection to abortions and mental health support. Experts say an uptick in armed conflict and the withdrawal of some UN peacekeepers is behind the surge. Gabriella Emmanuel, NPR News.
The Players Union for the WNBA has opted out of its current contract with the league. Both sides will now bargain over a new contract. The union says it's seeking higher salaries for WNBA players after a year with record attendance and viewership. The league also signed a media rights deal worth $200 million a year. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Nature Conservancy, working across oceans and isles to cut carbon emissions, protect lands and waters, and support local communities for a future where people and nature thrive. Nature.org/solutions.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and it is our fall fun drive. Joined in the studio by Patricia Rubio to remind you that this election season, it's not only important to vote, it's important to donate so we can continue to bring you all of the election information you need to keep you connected this election season here at Radio Catskill.
Yeah, and a way to donate is give us a call here at 845-482-4141 and donate online at wjffradio.org.
And when we say we're keeping you connected, we are keeping you connected. We have a lot of election coverage. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk to the Ulster County Board of Elections about the process there. And tonight on Radio Catskill at 7, it's a live debate from Pennsylvania's 8th Congressional District. Incumbent Matt Cartwright faces challenger Rob Bresnahan. It's a simulcast presentation from WVIA-TV. Following that, stay with us for new conversations with the candidates in New York's 100th Assembly District. Republican Lou Ingrassia Jr. and Democrat Paula Kay vying for that seat that Aileen Gunther has held for a while and is retiring this year, so they're vying for that. They spoke at the NAACP Candidates Night recently. We're bringing you that conversation. You were at another NAACP Candidates Night last night.
Yeah.
That was with Mark Molinaro, the incumbent Republican for New York's 19th Congressional District, and his challenger, Josh Riley. And if that sounds familiar, it's a repeat of the 2022 race. How did that go last night?
It was a well-attended event. It was a packed house at the Black Library in Monticello, which was really great to see that space really filled up. And a lot of concerned voters were there. Questions were asked. It was a great, I think it was a great mix of Democrats and Republicans or independents that were there. It seems like a mix of both parties were in attendance there.
Yeah, and we'll be bringing you that conversation as well. We recorded that conversation. We have a lot of conversations from our partnership with the Sullivan County NAACP to bring you not only the one tonight with the New York 100th Assembly race, but then also there was one with the New York State Senate race, New York's 51st incumbent Senator, State Senator Peter Oberrocker, and challenger Democrat Michelle Frazier. We're bringing that to you this coming Friday at 11. And again, lots of information. If you've missed any of our conversations this election or you need more information, go to our website, wjffradio.org. You'll find the election page. And on the election page, not only all the interviews that we've done, but election news and then also candidate profiles. You'll see the candidate's guide up there. You can learn about all of the different races. And then Vote 411, which is a service from the League of Women Voters Education Fund. You can punch in your information, your address there, find out what's on your ballot, where you can register, where your polling place is, all of that basic information that you probably need, we all need, to vote, which is our duty. And also, I would say, your duty as a listener for WJFF is to donate during our fall fun drive.
Yes, give us a call here at 845-482-4141 or donate online at wjffradio.org.
wjffradio.org or 845-482-4141. We are over the halfway mark, 53% of the way there. This is great. We're pacing well. We're ending it Friday at midnight, but we need to hear from folks who haven't donated yet. If you're a new listener and you've been meaning to donate, or you're an old listener and you've been meaning to donate, donate now. 845-482-4141. 4141 or WJFFradio.org. We're committed to bringing you this election coverage because there's so much out there in the world that's going on. And if you pay attention to the news, you might hear about how there are some misinformation out there, right? Mm. It's happening in our area. You spoke to the Ulster County Board of Elections late last week.
Yes.
And then on Sunday, the Ulster County Sheriff's Department was dispatched to remove a sign that falsely claimed voters needed to provide ID in order to vote. That followed a complaint filed with the New York State Attorney General's office, which swiftly addressed the issue as well. But the Ulster County Board of Elections is emphasizing that such disinformation is posing a threat to the democratic process and that they're taking it seriously. And a reminder that in New York, no voter ID is required to cast a ballot at any poll. So again, important to stay aware and informed of what's going on. If you're listening to us in Pennsylvania or another state, check with your local board of elections, different rules. But in New York State, you don't need to have a voter ID. The voter identity is verified through signature verification in accordance with New York state law. That's right. How it works in New York. Any messaging, signage, or statements indicating otherwise is misleading and a form of misinformation. As we said, the sheriff's department was dispatched. There's been a complaint to the New York State Attorney General's office. Ulster County Commissioner John Quigley said, quote, misinformation about voter ID requirements is not only deceptive, but dangerous. We are working diligently to prevent the spread of disinformation and will continue to enforce the law to protect voters, end quote. And a reminder again, to vote in New York, individuals just have to meet this eligibility requirement, be a U.S. citizen, be 18 years old by election day, and have registered to vote by providing a valid form of ID during the registration process. And again, the deadline to register is this Saturday, October 26th. Yeah. In New York. You can register up until that time if you meet that eligibility. For the most accurate and up-to-date information, again, contact your local Board of Elections in New York. If you're concerned, visit the official New York Board of Elections, New York State Board of Elections website, elections.ny.gov. And again, you spoke with the folks at Ulster County Board of Elections late last week. Who did you speak with?
I spoke with Ashley Torres and John Quigley, and we spoke about some of the things that you just mentioned now, the security and I guess the transparency and having a secure election.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that they care about most.
Yeah. And we all should care. So here's that conversation.
October 26th is the first day for early voting, the last day that someone can register to vote, and it's the last day that someone can request a ballot to vote by mail for us to send it to them in the mail. They can always come for a ballot after that date, but then they have to appear in person up until the day before the election. They can do that.
Now, I know sometimes there are changes in polling places. I know here in Sullivan County, sometimes they do change. John, if you want to speak on where can folks go to see if their polling chain location has changed or not?
So here in Ulster County, if you're looking to see where your poll sites are, you can go to voteulster.com, and it's one of our leading links that allows you to search not only your registration status, but also the poll site that you're responsible for looking at.
Now, this is a very busy period for both of you. What does the day look like for you now leading up to the election?
A bit longer. We have the staff, people start coming in around 7:30 a.m. to get started on the day's worth of registration processing, as well as processing the applications for the people that want to vote through the mail. And then we stay anywhere from 6 to 7. Today, we're going to be open a little bit later, probably leaving around 8 o'clock. And that's the next 19 days. That's just going to be more of a common occurrence where we're here. We joke that we basically live here now, and it feels like that in a lot of ways, but it's almost over. And when it's done, then we'll just be proud that we did as much as we could for the voters. And that's really what keeps us focused.
Now, are you still looking for volunteers to help at an election night or with early voting?
We're always actively looking. We're never going to say no to new people who want to get involved and help us actively run our elections. We are in the final week of our training classes for one of our last positions that we have here in Ulster County. But we will be taking names and any individual who is interested in working for us, because we always do what we call emergency training classes, where usually the last minute call outs, the people who have the inability to work and only let us know on short notice, aren't able to make it, we still need a list of people who we can place on election day, even if we're calling them at 5 in the morning to let them know that at 5 in the morning is when we first found out that somebody's not going to be able to make it.
Right. Now, as I said, early voting starts on October 26th, 9 days before the election day. What locations are for folks in Ulster County can partake in early voting?
We have 6 early voting sites in Ulster County. Our voters can go to any of those 6 early voting sites to cast their ballot. They are in, we have them, I think it's pretty geographically dispersed. We have one up in Saugerties at the Saugerties Senior Center. That's part of the Cantine Field complex up there. In Olive, we have it at the American Legion Hall, which is right off of Route 28 going up to the Catskills. So there's one up there. In Kingston, we have one on Broadway at the Midtown Neighborhood Center. And down in New Paltz, we have one at the New Paltz Community Center off 32. In Marlborough, we have one at their new community center. And then over in Ellenville, we have one at the Ellenville Library.
Now, naturally, this is a topic that a lot of folks talk about, the security of the casting of the votes. What measures are in place to ensure the security of votes cast by mail or in person?
So it's important to note, in New York State, what we do is we operate in a bipartisan manner. And as you're hearing from two of us today, there's always one Democrat and one Republican every step of the way. And this goes from the moment you check in at your registration table when you're voting on election day to the moment you cast your ballot. There are still two individuals who are at the machines when you cast your ballots, and all the way up until when we certify the election. Regardless of the aspect of which way you vote, we have a check and a balance and audit process that takes place so that it ensures that no matter what, in the concern that people have that an election is going to be rigged, it would take a bipartisan agreement for once, and it would take more than two people to actively do that. So in New York, we are thankful that this is our method, that it is done in a bipartisan manner, and that there is a Democrat and a Republican every step along the way, and that there's always a paper trail, that not only the ballots are paper, but when we do our audits, there's documentation of all the process that goes through from the moment you check in to the moment you vote.
It's just great to know that your vote will be secure and during this election season for Ulster County. Now, as far as the counting of the ballots, when do you start counting the ballots with early voting and in mail-in ballots? Does that get counted before the election day or starting on election day or after the polls close?
So for mail-in ballots that have been coming in with people's votes inside of them, we prepare them for canvass twice a week. On Tuesdays and Fridays, we open any valid ballots that have been returned and prepare them for scanning. They're then going to be scanned. A few times we scan them. That's all written out in the election law when we're required to start scanning those. They get scanned and then they're put into a secure locked box, which is then inside of a locked room that there's all these fail-safe redundancies to secure them. And then we open up early voting sites on the 26th. That's people going in and casting a ballot on one of our voting machines. Those two pieces of data, those two streams of voting, are part of our first initial reporting on election night. So at 9 o'clock, the polls close. That's when we can also first access and see what those results for the mail-in ballots and the early votes that were cast at the early voting sites. Those get tabulated and we then release them to the public within minutes of ourselves even being able to access them. They're up on the website and that's the first returns that people will see. The returns on election day, they have to physically come back to our office from wherever that poll site is located in Ulster. And since we have Ulster County is a pretty large county geographically, I've always heard that it's geographically the size of Rhode Island. I've never fact-checked that, but I just take it for face value that it is a very large county. And we have poll sites all over the county. We have 83 poll sites. So those memory cards that have the results on them from the voting machines, they have to come back to us. So there is a little bit of a wait time. Of course, we get returns back from Kingston, where our office is, the towns that are around Kingston. And as they come back from wherever that poll site was, we upload those and add them to the election night results. You start to see that being reflected on our website where we house the results on VoteUlster.com. There's a percentage that will rise as the night goes on. And we usually have everything up within 2 hours of the polls closing. So that's past practice, and that's hopefully what we'll see. We don't have any hiccups, and everything is up on the website no later than 11 p.m.
Now, on election night, when the results starts coming in after 9 o'clock, you mentioned a website, if you can mention it again, where folks can go and see the results.
Yes, that's easiest to... When you go to VoteUlster.com on election night, we redirect and we have a main link on our website that will allow you to see local results, and it will also direct you towards the state website where you can go and see statewide results.
All right, great, great. So I'm sure you guys are, like I said, is all the Board of Elections folks that we spoke to recently are all very busy, like much as like you guys are leading up to the election. I'm sure you will be very busy on election night. Is there anything I have not mentioned that you want folks, voters to know leading up to the election?
Just a friendly reminder, turn over your ballot. There are propositions on the back of the ballot this year. There's one statewide proposition. There's two county for Ulster County propositions. And if you happen to live in a town, there's some towns that will have a handful of propositions as well for their local towns.
Yeah, and we also really stress for people to check their registration before the cutoff date. They have 10 days left to register, and we want to make sure that when they go to vote, they don't have any issues. So if they've moved and they haven't updated their address, they should be checking on that too. And they should check before they submit a new form. Oftentimes we get forms back from voters and nothing has changed. It's a duplicate. And we don't know that until we start the process of looking it up. So the more duplicates we have, the less time we have to actually process new forms or changes to people's records. And that's obviously very burdensome. It takes away the time that we should be focusing on helping people who have a change or have not registered. So we very much emphasize to the public, check before you register again.
And the website is VoteUlster.com, and that redirects you to the election, Ulster County Board of Elections. We were talking to Ashley Torres and John Quigley from the Ulster County Board of Elections. Thank you so much for talking to me about the upcoming election, and good luck this season. I hope you get some rest somewhere.
Thank you.
Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
And a reminder again, our election coverage continues tonight at 7. It's a live debate with the Pennsylvania 8th Congressional District candidates, incumbent Matt Cartwright, the Democrat facing challenger Republican Rob Bresnahan. It's a simulcast presentation from WVIA-TV. And then stay with us after for new conversations with the candidates in New York's 100th Assembly race, Republican Lou Ingrassia Jr. and Democrat Paula Kay. They spoke at last week's NAACP Candidates Night. We'll have that for you tonight at 8 as we keep you connected this election season. And find out all of our election coverage and ways you can check your election status with Vote 411 at our website, wjffradio.org. You can also donate there because it's our fall fund drive. We want to thank Bruce in Brooklyn who donated online. Thank you so much, Bruce. You have helped us move the wheel of progress. We're now at 54% of our goal. Can you help? Have you donated yet? Do it now at 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the season of the witch, witchcraft in the Catskills, coming up after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast, a newly renovated farmhouse that sleeps four with full gourmet cook breakfast provided daily, located near the top of Hauk Mountain Road in the town of Walton. More information at GreatWesternCatskills.com.
Hi, I'm Brent Jones, Senior News Apps Developer at NPR.
I'm Casey Morell, and I produce the NPR Politics Podcast.
My name is Kristen Hartman. I'm the Senior Manager of Business Development at NPR.
I work in public media for a lot of reasons, but the main one is that first word, public. What we do is available to everyone, everywhere.
I started at NPR answering phones when listeners called. And I stay in public media because I'm just insatiably curious about what we can do and create when we all work together.
I've worked in public media for more than a decade. because I believe it's important to help people understand the world around them, how we got here, what's happening now, where we're going, and why it matters to all of us.
Help keep public media strong today by making a donation to this station. Here's how, and thank you.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And yes, we are in our fall fund drive. We're looking for your support. Your support ensures that Radio Chatskill remains that trusted source of information for informed conversations that foster community interaction and bring people together. And our mission is to create a more informed public. And you're part of that. You're here to help keep this public radio station available to the public with your donation. We're listener-supported nonprofit public radio, so we rely on your support. We call on you a few times a year to donate to help keep it going. We're 54% of the way during this fall fund drive. And so we need to hear from you at 845-482-4141 or go to WJFFradio.org. If you like what you're hearing, call us and let us know. Show your appreciation for the local news, the national news, the world news, and all of the great local music we have, too, to give you a break from that news. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. Now, just in time for Halloween, the latest edition of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast, Brett Berry sat down with historian Samantha Misa in the Frisbee Family Cemetery to uncover some witchy tales from our collective Catskills past. Samantha Misa shares some haunted encounters from Delaware County's Frisbee House and recounts tales from her book, Witches of the Catskills. Plus, Misa recounts the challenges of researching historical witchcraft using old newspapers and archival records to reconstruct the tales.
According to the National Retail Federation, 2024's top Halloween costumes include ghosts, superheroes, Disney princesses, vampires, pirates, Beetlejuice characters, and witches. For children, the witch is ranked number 4. For adults, it's the number 1 costume, and even for pets, a witch costume makes the list. Pets aside, though, 12.2 million Americans plan on dressing up as a witch. There was a time, though, that identifying as a witch, or being branded as one, had truly scary consequences. I spoke with historian Samantha Misa, author of Witches of the Catskills, about witches and witchcraft in our Catskills past. We conducted our interview, where else, in a family cemetery in Delaware County.
My name is Samantha Misa. I work at the Delaware County Historical Association here in Delhi. And right now we are in the Frisbee Family Cemetery out behind the historic Frisbee House. The cemetery is where Gideon Frisbee, the builder of the house, and his family members are buried. So we have Frisbee himself, his first wife Hulda, and his second wife Freelove are up here, along with several of their children.
Before we get into the witches of the Catskills, tell me a little bit about the Frisbee family and their significance to this county.
So the Frisbee family came to Delaware County before it was Delaware County in the 1790s. They came from Connecticut. Gideon Frisbee was a Revolutionary War veteran. He and his wife Hulda came here, and they first built a small cabin. While they were living in that cabin, they constructed the Frisbee House and completed it by 1797. Gideon Frisbee and his wife Hulda lived there with 6 of their children. When Hulda died, Gideon married his neighbor, Freelove, and they had 6 more children, so the Frisbee family was quite large. But the house itself is also very significant, not just due to its age, but because it is the birthplace of Delaware County. Gideon Frisbee was a judge and a tavern owner, and in his tavern is where several supervisors met in 1797 to create Delaware County out of the surrounding counties. So it's the birthplace of our county. A lot of people ask me, is the house haunted? And I have to say, that depends on when you ask me. If I'm in the house with a lot of people, the answer is no. If I'm in the house by myself, I definitely think it is. We do offer lantern tours of the house. I've had people tell me that they saw an apparition on the stair, on the bottom of the staircase, that appeared to be dressed in 1920s clothing. And once they looked at it, realized it was something else there, took a second look, the figure had vanished. Most of the stories about the house being haunted take place in the house's nursery, where a lot of people attribute that perhaps to the death of the Frisbee's young son, George, who died in infancy. People have said that they've seen a woman rocking a baby in the rocking chair up there, and a lot of individuals on tours or just taking a walk through the house by themselves have said that they feel a presence in the nursery. And many different people with no connection to one another have said something of a similar sentiment to me, that the nursery makes them feel strange, or that there's a presence or an entity that exists there that makes them uncomfortable. And that's where a lot of the strange energy seems to emanate from.
What inspired Witches of the Catskills?
A few years ago, back in 2019, I was going through some volumes we had in our archives. We had old volumes of a magazine called The Courier, Courier Magazine. And it was published in the 1950s out of the Delaware County town of Deposit. And there was one issue that actually had a title that was The Austin Witch of Trout Creek, a real witch haunted a mountaintop farmhouse in the early 19th century. And it was a very interesting story about a 19th century farmhouse. In the 1860s, there was a farm family in Trout Creek that was plagued by very strange events going on. The family was very well respected, but they had very odd occurrences happening. The woman's dress was found shredded, even though it was in a locked closet. There was an instance where a barrel full of liquid kitchen waste was found upside down, but the liquid waste was still inside. Farm tools would disappear and reappear stuck in the loft of the barn where, according to the family, no human could have put them. And they blamed witchcraft, and that was the heart of the story. So having read that one, and that story and its outcome is included in the book, I was inspired to try to find others. Were there other tales of witchcraft in the Catskills, or was that story of the Trout Creek witch unique? And it turned out there was other tales of witchcraft, many of which actually did not have a witch that was named. A lot of them were simply strange occurrences where people would blame witchcraft as the cause, but without having any specific person to pin the blame on.
So this led you to do further research and discover many witchy tales in the Catskills, right?
Yes. So I took that, and my goal was to try to not just tell the story, but add a little bit more to it. So see if I could prove anything or find more of an outcome, because a lot of the stories that I would find would be very incomplete, just sort of a reference in a newspaper or very fragmentary tales here and there in a folklore journal, or just a small reference, a little thing on a map that would say Witch's Point or something like that. So I tried to really round out the stories and do more research. With the Trout Creek witch, I tried to find a little bit more about the family, and I was able to verify that everything they said in that story was true. There was a family. The names all checked out. According to census records, they were there. Burial records, they did exist. The story itself obviously still remains a bit of a mystery, but there were plenty of elements of truth in that, so maybe there were elements of truth in other parts of it. But I looked to add more stories of witchcraft. Was that one the only one? And it turns out there was a lot. I was able to find, mostly through newspapers, but also through folklore journals, maps, booklets, anything I could find that would have a reference to witches. The biggest challenge was a lot of search features. If you're looking through old newspapers and they're digitized, you search the word witch, you're going to find a lot of references and advertisements of people trying to sell you witch hazel as an astringent or a facial cleanser. So it was kind of hard to narrow down and find the witches that I was actually looking for. But there were tales out there to be discovered. There's not a lot to go on. Everything is so vague, so apocryphal, so just nebulous in many cases, that it makes it very difficult to elaborate more. You want to know more about the tale. Who was that person? What were they accused of doing? And you only have some fragments, little shreds of evidence, little bits and pieces peppering your archives that you can go and try to sew together to make a coherent story out of.
It's interesting that those bits and pieces were published in newspapers, though. I don't think that would happen now.
No, and actually, part of the reason I think newspapers published it was almost because they were poking fun at maybe a continued belief or superstition in witchcraft. There is a current in a lot of them that the people that were doing that were somehow backwards or simpletons or something like that. So a lot of the witch stories are tinged with that almost condescension, that there are still people living way out in the backwoods that are putting silver coins under a baby's cradle or nailing a horseshoe above the barn door to prevent witchcraft. And there is some tone of making fun of them for this continued belief when the rest of the world has moved on and embraced modernity.
And the witchcraft or the witch-inspired stories, were these real women? Were there real women who they called witches? I know in some of your stories, there were a lot of cats that, I guess, embodied the witch.
Mm-hmm.
Or were they just strange occurrences that were attributed to witchcraft or a combination of all three?
Oh, it was a combination of all three. There's a lot of stories where it would just simply be something strange happening or something disturbing, and witchcraft was simply blamed without anybody there to put the blame on. So if somebody's cow wasn't producing milk or crops were failing, it was simply witchcraft that was blamed for it. There was also a couple occurrences where there were women who were blamed. The difficulty with that was a lot of times they would just be given a simple name like Witch McGraw or Mother Smith or something very, very simple that would be very difficult to verify with a census. So it's unknown if they were actually real or if this was something that was just given to a certain individual. But a lot of times the blame was placed on someone. A lot of times it was a woman. Usually she was older, maybe a bit ostracized from the community. But there were also plenty of instances where it was a male who was blamed for it. There was a murder that took place in Sullivan County, and the man was murdered because he was actually suspected of performing witchcraft by a neighbor.
Wow.
We see people immigrating from Europe bringing belief of witchcraft with them. And there does tend to be a very long history of that, where witchcraft is not necessarily put on one person. It just exists in the ether. The term a lot of people use to describe it is maleficium, where it's just there's simply bad energy out there or dark energy. And some people have the ability to harness it and use it to harm others. But it just exists, so it can hurt you without being directed by someone, but usually it is. And that belief in maleficium and witches is something that culturally you can see follow a lot of settlers and a lot of immigrants from the old world, if you will, immigrating to North America even in the 16, 1700s, and so we do see a bit of a continuation with that.
And the Catskills are a dense and dark place in areas, so, you know, lots of tales come out of the forests of the Catskills, and I guess that might also have something to do with it.
And the Catskills are kind of a dark and mysterious land. They were never very densely settled, still to this day, pretty light population numbers in several of the Catskill counties. Early documentation of the Catskills talk about it as a dark and howling wilderness, that there were scary animals and wildlife and very dense forests around. So naturally that kind of lends credence to there being some supernatural entity at place, or that this would be somewhere that some type of force like that would be at home. It comes from very early American beliefs following the Puritans, who were very well known for their belief in witchcraft, that the devil occupied the woods. You were a lot more safe in a civilized area, in a town or a settlement. And if there's not a lot of those around, then the devil has quite a big playing field.
Was there anything in your research on these stories that sent a chill down your spine? Or did you take everything with a healthy dose of skepticism?
I try to take things with a healthy dose of skepticism, but I'm also the person that does tours of the Frisbee House at night, the last one to lock up afterwards. So I like to think that I'm receptive to the possibility that anything exists and anything can happen. There were a couple stories in there that did send a little bit of a shiver down my spine. There was one story of a cat that talked and was suspected of being somehow connected to witchcraft. And I've heard the story before. It's kind of made its rounds among folklorists, and I've heard it in several different places. But what really caught my eye about it was there were a lot of elements of the story that I couldn't verify. Via census records, the family mentioned in the story did exist. And looking at a map of the area, I was trying to pinpoint where exactly the farm was that all of these strange occurrences with the talking cat happened. And there it was on a historic map, and the family name was right there, Mayhem Pond, on Mayhem's farm in Schoharie County. There is a lot of connection that we can see between cats, particularly black cats, and magic, superstition, and the occult. We also see just connection with animals in general, too. A lot of times any trouble or problems with animals were connected with witchcraft, and people suspected of witches were oftentimes suspected of shapeshifting into animals. There's another story where there's a young man attempting to hunt partridges, and despite being a very good shot, he could not hit a single one. When he went back to his family to report his bad luck in hunting, they suspected witchcraft and told him to use a silver bullet next time. Next time the young man went out to hunt the partridges, he shot at them with a silver bullet, and to his surprise, the partridges vanished, and in their place was a woman in town who had been suspected of witchcraft and other strange behavior. So the implication is that she was shapeshifting into the partridges, and that's why he was having such bad luck getting any. there is one story that I did come across after the book had already been published, and it involves a story that had occurred in Esperance, New York. There was a woman in Esperance who was suspected of doing some strange things. Reportedly, according to her neighbors, she was able to take her apron off, use it as a raft across the river, and when she got to the other side, she would put the apron back on and it would be perfectly dry. So there were some highly suspect things she was doing. According to the tale of the Esperance Witch, her behavior was so concerning to the locals that they shot her and buried her upside down with a stake through her head in order to prevent her from reincarnating or from reanimating and coming back to haunt them. But those details are about all there is to this story. There's not a lot of names or anything verifiable, and as a historian, we like evidence. We like to be able to prove what we say. So it's difficult and a little frustrating to not have much more to go on.
Do you believe in witches?
I believe in everything. I definitely think that there were witches, and I think there still are.
Just maybe not how they're portrayed.
I think there's just like anything, there's probably good witches and bad witches out there. We'll go with some Wizard of Oz logic and say that there's a little bit of everything. But having researched this and having been able to find some things that did verify a lot of the stories, I see no reason why some of them can't be true and why that can't still remain true today.
Is Halloween a big holiday for you? Do you enjoy, I don't know, the ability to embrace things that are spooky?
I do really enjoy Halloween. I enjoy the ambiance of it. I enjoy just the time of year. I enjoy the weather in autumn. And I enjoy the fact that it's the kind of the season where you can start talking about witchcraft and talk about haunted houses. And not as many people as usual are going to look at you askance. There'll always be some, though.
That is from the Cat's Cast podcast, Brett Berry interviewing historian Samantha Misa in the Frisbee Family Cemetery in Delaware County. You can find that full episode at catscast.com. Cat's Cast is the biweekly series featuring Catskills culture, history, and scary stuff, it seems, during Halloween season. I'm Tim Bruno, and I'm in the studio now with Maggie Fitzpatrick. No ghost, no talking cat. Maggie Fitzpatrick, you're keeping me company because I got shivers.
Yes.
That was good.
It was good.
I didn't, like, yo, the witch with the raft apron, I didn't, ooh, what's happening?
I'm not very educated in that part of, you know, potential beings, but that was definitely
Samantha dove in for you, and we were able to bring you some information there thanks to our partnership with Brett and the Cat's Cast podcast. You know, they've been voted best regional podcast 3 years in a row.
Oh, that's incredible.
Very nice. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, joined by Maggie Fitzpatrick here for not only her regular segment on Tuesdays, which is Moving Toward Health, also the name of her column in the Sullivan County Democrat, but also because it's our fall fund drive, asking for your support, 845-482-4141. I wonder if there were any healthy ghosts or witches back in the day in the Catskills.
Probably.
Maybe. And did they keep promises to themselves? I was trying to do a segue for your...
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Your column this week is Keeping Promises to Ourselves. You say you always enjoyed the quote, commitment is staying true to what you said you would do long after the mood that you said it in it has left. I would say that maybe that's true when it comes to donating to our fall fund drive for folks. So that's commitment. If you said you're going to do it and the mood is left, or just stay committed, donate now, 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. Maybe that was a better connection there.
Yeah, it definitely applies.
There. So tell us why you have this as your topic for this week's Moving Toward Health column in the Sullivan County Democrat.
I think it's something that's just always relevant and always challenging, you know, just one of those things that is always hard. But that quote, you know, it really sticks with me because it's easy to say you're going to do something and it's hard to do it, right? It's easy to say you're going to do something in a moment where your emotions are aligned with taking action on that thing. So that could be like you're feeling excited, you know, or you have a lot of energy, or you're feeling inspired, right? And it's easy when you're feeling that type of way to say you're going to do something. And then once those feelings are gone, because they never stick around forever, right? They always come and go. Then it becomes really challenging to actually take action on those things. And so, that's where, you know, kind of the topic of the rest of the article comes into play, which is discipline.
Discipline. And you talk about discipline. And when you practice it, you split yourself into two people. Oh, there's a spooky thing.
Yeah. I guess that kind of.
What do you mean? What do you mean by splitting yourself into two people to achieve this discipline?
Yeah. So this is the way that I look at it. I like to look at myself as me, Maggie, the person wanting to achieve the goal. That is me that, you know, goes through life, lives all of the different experiences. And I also like to look at myself as having another component, which is my coach. And it is my internal coach that lives in the same brain as the rest of me. And I need to split myself into those two people in order to stay disciplined and keep my promises to myself, because the part of me who's just going through life, me, it, like I said, it's hard to take action on those things when you don't feel like it. Mm. So it's just like having a coach outside of you. Let's say I was your coach, right? I could be there and say, come on, Tim, you know, you said you were going to go for a walk today. Why don't you go outside? Let me know when you're done, right? Well, I'm capable of doing that for myself in my own head as well. And I like to look at myself as having these two different personalities going on at the same time, because it makes it a little bit easier for me to stick to those promises if I have a part of me that's saying, no, you said you were going to do this. Like, let's go do it.
Yeah. And what about boundaries when it's, when you're trying to work with these two different versions of yourself in discipline?
Yeah, it can be challenging. It can be challenging to say that, you know, oh, I'm going to give in to not doing it today or something like that, right? So what I like to do is set, it's almost like I'm having a meeting, like these two people are having a meeting. And in that meeting, that initial meeting, we're saying, okay, this is the goal. This is what we're going to do to achieve that goal. And we're going to set some rules and some parameters, right, around what is allowed and what is not allowed for me to continue on this goal. And in this like initial meeting, that's where we set these mm-hmm. parameters, these boundaries. And then from then on, the coach is able to say, no, these are the rules. Like you said, you were not going to stay up past 11:30 PM because that really impacts your sleep. And then you, you know, struggle to get up in the morning or whatever the rule is. Right. So it's like, okay, we have to go to bed. Like, I know you don't want to go to bed right now, but it doesn't matter. We have to do it. Right. And that helps me keep those promises to myself, because otherwise it's just a free for all. Right. And that's where we struggle with achieving our goals, when we don't have, you know, boundaries and parameters to follow.
I got to keep a promise to ourselves, which is to get to the next segment. So this is a little shorter than usual with Maggie Fitzpatrick, because it's our fall fun drive and we've been asking for support. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. But keep your promise to yourself by not only donating, but going to read Maggie's Moving Toward Health column on newsstands in the Democrat right now, today, or online at SC Democrat Online. Maggie, thanks you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And,
the Upper Delaware Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is hosting a walkathon at the end of the month for social justice. It's a 5-mile route beginning at the Narrowsburg Union in Sullivan County. And Radio Catskills' Nia Watson met with Tom Rue to learn more about this event and its history.
The Bud Rue Memorial Walk for Social Justice will be kicking off at 10:15 on October 27th, the last Sunday of the month. I'm here with Tom Rue to learn more about the event. Hello, Tom. Thank you for joining us today. Can you please introduce yourself and tell us what you do for the Upper Delaware Unitarian Universalist Fellowship?
Well, thank you very much for allowing me on here to talk about this activity. For coming up on a year now, I've been the vice president of the Upper Delaware UU Fellowship. My involvement goes in the organization goes back to the beginning, though. We started meeting in 1987 and incorporated in 1990. When we incorporated, I was the president. So I was the first president after we were recognized by the state as an incorporated church. And I stayed active with fellowship for a number of years. And I moved to Monticello and got caught up in other activities that took me away from it. More recently in my life, I have found myself back closer to this area, the River Valley. About a year ago, there were a number of members of the board of directors who had become discouraged and were feeling burned out. There was talk about dissolving the fellowship. I was one of a few people who attended some organizational meetings that were organized by Reverend Lori Stewart, who's a member of the fellowship. The congregation voted in February that we would continue to meet and we would resume meeting weekly. The fellowship had been meeting every other week for a few months during the pandemic. But I agreed to be the vice president on the condition that Lori Stewart would be the president. And I'm grateful that she accepted that. So as vice president, my goal has just basically been to see the organization continue and increase in attendance and participation and bring a liberal religious fellowship alternative to the Upper Delaware River Valley.
And I noticed on the website that the fellowship aims to, quote, create a safe and welcoming space for people of all ages and backgrounds, close quote. So can you just tell me a bit about some of the ways that the fellowship does this, if you want to talk about any past initiatives or just kind of what the inner workings are like in the organization?
Well, I'm thinking back to the very beginning and over the years of the fellowship's existence, its size has gone up and down. Right now, the numbers are down. So it's hard to say that we have a diverse membership now because we have a very small membership. But everyone is welcome. And if you look at the on the website, if you look where it says press releases from 2024, that's another thing that I have done as vice president, was send out these press releases and email blasts. We have a mailing list of roughly 100 people and local media outlets. If you look at the types of programs that we've held, the speakers that we've invited in, and the audiences that a number of those speakers have attracted and brought with them, I think that illustrates the kind of diversity that we're interested in supporting.
Okay, great. So now I'd like to transition to talk about the upcoming walk and memorial. Would you mind telling us a bit about who was Bud Rue?
Okay. Bud Rue was my father. To the time period that we're talking about, he was retired. He had retired from teaching. He was a math teacher. And this is my recollection from, I was close with him during his last years. He devoted his last years to volunteer work. He organized Habitat for Humanity in Wayne County. I'm not shy about saying this because it's true. He was the person who took the initiative in Wayne County to get that chapter started, and it immediately caught hold to the point that it's still an active chapter. That's one of the effects of the work that he did in his last years in the nonprofit sector in this local area. My parents used to own a property in Milanville called Innisfree, and that's where the fellowship started. The very, very first meeting was held in the home of Reverend Ray Pontier on the Narrowsburg side of the river. And I think the second meeting in 1987 was held in the recreation hall at Innisfree, which my parents rented, did not charge rent. It was rent-free to the fellowship for the first several years that the fellowship existed. The fellowship contributed something for the heat expense and public liability insurance, but there was no rent as such. So, I mean, that was a concrete contribution that my father made to the fellowship, and the fellowship had its, I would say, ripple effects in the community that are still felt, not just by the birth of organizations like Habitat for Humanity. VIP is on the list this year, Victim Intervention Program. Habitat for Humanity and Women's Resource Center, which was a predecessor of the VIP program in Wayne County, the Domestic Violence Agency, was one of the original beneficiaries of this walkathon in 1993. Let me get back to Bud Rue. He was active in, like I say, in this type of work because Innisfree was meeting in the rec hall on the property that he owned. He was a member of the board of directors at that time, and he came to a board meeting, and as everyone knows, he's very busy with these activities, and I'm paraphrasing him now, but he said that we need to be doing something for the community. What can we be doing? And he pushed on that with the board for a period of months in 1993. And the way it was settled on by the group, and this was not my father's idea specifically, but it was a group process. The discussion led to the idea of holding fundraisers to benefit some local organizations that we support, that serve a social justice purpose in the community. And somebody suggested a walkathon. It was called the Walk for Social Justice for the Upper Delaware Fellowship. And the walk went from Narrowsburg to Milanville, which is about 5-6 miles. And just a mile or so into the walk, my father sat down on a rock because his leg hurt, and he was picked up by a sweep car who was driving back and forth. He used his asthma inhaler a few times in the car and appeared to fall asleep, according to Reverend Pontier, who was driving the sweep car. And when they got him back to Milanville, he had passed away. So that was a tragedy for my family, obviously. He was 59, and we still feel his loss. But the manner in which he passed drew a lot of attention and drew a lot of donations. And the amount that we raised that first year was a whole lot more than any of us anticipated that we would in, you know, kind of a fundraiser. So we divided it up four ways among the four groups that we had designated. And they're not always the same groups. They get designated by the board of directors each year. It was a pretty natural decision at the time to do it again next year in 1994. And I don't remember whose idea it was to name it the Bud Brew Memorial Walk for Social Justice, but that's what it's been called since then. Over the years, the Upper Delaware Unitarian Universalist Fellowship has made a substantial impact on the community, far beyond what you would expect from its small number of members.
Yes, and also thank you for sharing your father's story and my condolences to your family. So my next question is just for listeners who might not be familiar with how walkathons work. Can you explain a bit about how the event will go and maybe talk about the route that it will be following?
We're going to start at 10:15 in the Narrowsburg Union, which is where we normally meet in room 102, the former Narrowsburg Central School, as some remember it. And that'll be a brief meeting. We'll talk about the organization's Habitat for Humanity of Wayne County, Victims Intervention Program of Wayne County, Growing Older Together, which is Sullivan County based, and Sullivan Allies Leading Together, SALT. We'll talk briefly about those four organizations. I think that representatives of those organizations will probably all be there. I've heard from SALT, GOT, and Habitat. As far as the route, we will, as I said, we'll be meeting at the Narrowsburg Union, and we'll walk down Bridge Street to turn left on Main Street in Narrowsburg, which is just a few blocks long, and then turn right near the Laundrette restaurant and down into Narrowsburg Flats. And we have a map that it's on our website, upperdelawareuu.org. It shows the route around the flats. It's all a residential neighborhood. We will hope to see some friendly people waving hello as we walk by.
So how are you accepting donations? What are some of the ways that people can donate?
Well, one way is the old-fashioned way is through the U.S. Postal Service, the Upper Delaware Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, P.O. Box 47, Narrowsburg, New York, 12764. If you're doing it that way, it's important to put on the memo portion of the check. This is a donation for the Bud Brew Memorial Fund, or you can abbreviate it BRM or Social Justice Fund or something, just so the treasurer knows this is for the walkathon. In addition to that, this year for the first time, we're also accepting donations on PayPal. So if you go to the website, there's a code that you can scan there with your phone and go in that way. If you have a chance to go to the website and download a pledge sheet and collect some donations, that is much, much better. But if you want to just come and go for a walk with us, you're also welcome to do that.
And so with that in mind, what are you hoping to accomplish with this event?
Well, number one, we want to support the groups that have been chosen this year to benefit from the funds. We want to support the changes that those groups represent and bring to our community. Now, as a fellowship, as an organization, as a congregation, we also hope to continue to exist, but that requires public awareness of who we are and of the kinds of things that we offer and support. Raising funds to benefit housing for the homeless, support services for victims and the elderly, getting food boxes and equity to the communities in Sullivan County.
And is there anything else that folks should know about the event or the fellowship that I might have forgotten to ask?
Wear a hat. If it's raining, what we have said is that we will hold it. We have held them in the past before. Prepare for the weather and wear some good shoes.
That's great advice. Also, as the weather is starting to really get cooler. Thank you so much, Tom Rue from the Upper Delaware Unitarian Universalist Fellowship Vice President. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure talking with you.
In Liberty, I'm Nia Watson for Radio Catskill.
And that will do it for this edition of Radio Catskill. Reminder, our election coverage continues tonight with the live debate from Pennsylvania's 8th Congressional District, followed by a conversation between candidates from the New York 100th Assembly race, who spoke at last week's NAACP Candidate Night. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. This is WJFF Jeffersonville Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, sunny, very warm, high 77. It's 11 o'clock.